You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Fred Wilcox. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to have you here this morning.
And, thank you. It's good to be here.
And so the way we start the show and the question that, you know, that's not easy to answer, but it's a quick, it's a way to give a picture. Who are you? You know, what do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, that's a great question, and I think I'm still working on that. I'm not sure who I am. I'm trying to be a person who lives a peaceful life, who believes in justice, practices justice, things like that, but I'm still evolving. I think I'll probably evolve, and maybe on my deathbed, if somebody asks me that question, I'll say, now I know.
Well, or you at least you know how that chapter closed.
Yes, I will.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you say that, also, do you want to say how old you are?
Yes, I'm 75.
Okay. Yep. And so, and that's, you know, we need to hear that. You know, we need to hear that. Thank you. What about anything else you want to say about who you are?
Well, yeah, I think who I am is class. My daughter, or daughters used to say to me, well, no, Dad, you're a college professor, you're a writer, you've published books, you know, you're not working class anymore. And I would always say, no, I am, because that's the way I see the world. That's the way I was raised, and that's the way I see the world. I'm pro-union. I'm all these things that really are working class. Not everybody in the working class is pro-union, but I think that really defines the way I see the world, always mm-hmm, has. Mm-hmm. And I keep waiting for a change. I keep thinking, well, one of these days I'll wake up and I'll see things in a different way. Somehow I'll leap to another class or climb to another class, but I haven't. And so I think my worldview and the way I see many, many things is through the class, that I'm working class.
Yeah, through the lens of economic class.
Absolutely.
And I grew up on a farm in rural poverty, which is not working class, but there are some profound similarities and profound differences in those perspectives. And I've had to come to terms with the fact that in certain culture, in certain settings, I am passing. Mm-hmm. And using that traditional term from Black culture, I'm passing white or passing. I'm not what people think I am because of the PhD that I have and the other degrees and things that I've done. But that's only a part of me, and so it's hard sometimes for. So I can understand the distinction your daughter is making, and she's calling you account to, because I'm called to account for that too, in a number of different ways.
But I think it to me, and I'll say I've lived in Ithaca for 30 years, so. It's very important in a lot of ways here, because I have discovered time and time again that when I'm talking about things like the military or just working or many other things, that some people who have never been there, who have never worked in a factory, never driven a truck in New York City, never worked on construction, whatever it is, really have difficulty. They can conceptualize the class. That is, they can imagine, because they want to support, you know, certain movements. But they really don't grasp it. They don't quite understand what it's like to be poor, for example.
Right. And it's not just a difference in what you can consume, and it's not just a difference in how you look at the day and how you work and how you see your body as a tool. There are lots of differences.
And I wasn't going to bring this up, but I think it's important to bring it up. People are agonizing, well, why is Donald Trump so popular? And I've been trying to say to some of my friends, he's popular because people, the working class, are angry, they're frustrated, and most of all, they're scared. I grew up in a family where we were scared all the time. On Friday, every Friday, my parents would sit down with the bills, and I remember my mother crying because they never had enough money to pay the bills, and they had to decide which ones they were going to pay. They were Depression-era survivors. My father was in World War II. They never had any security. They were very frightened. Were they alive today, would they vote for Trump? They might, simply because they also live their lives in that anger and that frustration and that bitterness of thinking, well, why doesn't anybody care about us?
Right.
It's very important to note that, I think, in the times we're living through right now.
And I think we also need to note that this is not a this is not just an issue for the Republican Party. It's a national issue. Poor whites have lost something like 10 years on their life expectancy in the last 50 years. And they've been abandoned by the Democratic Party for the most part. And they have been mocked and used by the Republicans over the years. And it's happening still.
Mocked and used. Yes.
And so it's just, we live in a mess. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, but, that's all right. And you know, my daughters, all of my children have college degrees. But it's not the people who just graduated from high school and didn't have a college yes. degree. One of my daughters is working in Pennsylvania at a terrible job. She's been there 17 years. She gets very little time off. It's a very oppressive work situation. Mm-hmm. She wants to quit, but she can't because she doesn't have any money. She's not voting for Trump because she wouldn't do that. But it's more to understand, it's not just people who are working in factories right. or are unemployed, but it's also college graduates, also all sorts of people. There just isn't any security in this country.
And we haven't faced each other as a whole.
Exactly.
In maybe forever, but it's been a very long time. You came with some music, and I think, you know, we're kind of our conversation has almost led into it. It's Barry McGuire and Eve of Destruction. Great. Do you want to say anything about it before we listen to it?
Well, I used to listen to Barry McGuire way back in the 60s, back in the day, and so I'd like to hear him again.
Okay, here we go.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy, it's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over. You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
And that was Barry McGuire and On the Eve of Destruction. And you're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Fred Wilcox. So, Fred, What I would like for you to do is to just think a bit about what are some of the major things that kind of shaped your life? What were the experiences that led you to be the person you've become? How did they happen?
Well, to begin with, I'd say jail. I was a juvenile delinquent growing up, and I was in jail. I got beat up by the police. You know, I used to think those things were quite terrible, but after a while, I began to see them as benefits in a way, because I understood what it's like to be in jail, what it's like to be beaten up by the police. The first time I was beaten up by the police, I was in a sort of a gang situation, and somebody knocked me down. I was down on my knees. I got up. I tried to get up. I saw the blue, and I stood up and threw my arms out and said, no, I'm not fighting. And at that point, the policeman beat me, punched me in really badly. Threw me in a car, charged me with resisting arrest, charged me with assaulting a police officer, right. Lots of charges. Took me down to the city jail in Des Moines, Iowa, which is a very terrible place to be at the time, maybe still. And so I had some experiences at a very young age. But I think the most, probably one of the most important experiences, I was attacked by a group of African-American men when I was 15 years old on a street corner who said they wanted to kill a white blank, blank, blank. And at the point, I was with my friends. My friends got away. They ran, and I didn't get to run. So these guys beat me. They clubbed me. They stabbed me. They knocked my teeth out. It was a very violent altercation. And I woke up in the hospital, and people find this hard to believe, but it was not exactly a mystical experience, but it was fabulous and amazing experience. I looked at my hands. My head was a mountain range. You know, I was seriously had a serious brain concussion. Looked at my hands, and I thought, my God, you know, they tried to kill me because I'm white. Mm-hmm. I'd never really thought about being white. I just, yeah, I was white. And then I said, and we're always killing them because they're black. We're always attacking him and killing him. And that was the beginning of a lifelong effort to understand racism, to understand slavery, to understand the way our culture works, the way we live together or don't live together. So that was really a very, very important thing in my life. I wouldn't want to do it again, but that's a true story. I looked at my hands, and I'm white, they're black. And then I didn't try to be black. I wasn't a Uyghur. But I tried to hang out with black people. I would go to clubs, and I'd get beat up again, you know. And I played black music, and I just kept trying to understand what it would be like to be on the other side, to be the other guy. Sure. Of course, I never understood. I'm not black. I never, you know, I have a doctorate. One of my areas of doctoral study was African-American literature. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand it. I'll never understand it because I looked at the New York Times today, and there was another young black kid has been killed by the police. And it's just such a tragic thing. You know, we have evolved in this country since I was 15 years old. We have evolved in many ways, and yet we're still facing this horrible violence against African American people.
Right, right. And yes, but I also, without in any way diminishing that, I also want to note that in all likelihood, at least from my impression, the fathers of two of my closest friends in elementary school were both in prison, white guys. And my guess is that the rate of incarceration of white guys was higher back in the 40s when you were attacked and the 50s and 60s when I was growing up. And many of us can remember what it's like to either have been through that experience as you have, or to have friends that were deeply influenced by that experience. Whereas now with the racism in incarceration, we don't necessarily have that as white folks.
Yeah, we don't have that perspective, and we need that perspective. I happen to have two family members who are in prison. A very, very good friend, Marianne Grady. I'm sure you know her and everybody. I just went up to visit her the other night, who's in prison for stepping over a line, taking photographs, not even demonstrating, not harming, not threatening, not doing anything to anybody. We have lots of people in prison. We have the highest rate of prison of any country in the world. And yes, they're white, they're black, they're brown, they're Native American, they're women and men. Right. We just put people in prison and we keep them there. My cousin's in prison for a DWI. He's doing his fourth year, and it appears that he's not getting out. I wrote to the parole board and said, this guy is about as, you know, dangerous as my dog. I didn't say that exactly. But, you know, the question is, why do we keep these people in prison? Have you seen Michael Moore's great new film? Mm-hmm. It's an industry. And in this industry, it does, I don't, yes, there are more black people. Yes, there are more people of color in prison. But there are all kinds of people in prison.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's kind of partly my point. But and we we live in a time where it's almost loaded to talk about distributions.
Well, it is loaded, but we, you know, ever since the 60s, and one of the things that really defines me today and defined me then was the Vietnam War, the Vietnam, you know, and the assassinations and all the street violence, which I was subject to because I was out in the streets. We've, the left, progressive, whatever you want to call us, people who oppose war and things like that, we have divided. And ourselves, LBJ said when he retired, or left office, not retired, he said, look, I never worried about the left. He said the Trotskyites, the Stalinists, et cetera, et cetera. But, and then he said, he paused, and this is true. You can find it somewhere probably out there. He said, God help America if the right wing ever takes over. Well, the right wing is taking over, has taken over a lot. But the problem I'm talking about here is we say, well, if you're not this group, if you're not this sexuality, et cetera, we define suffering and exploitation in terms of just sometimes race or just times sexuality or just if you're poor or not. And I think if we're going to get anywhere in this country, if we're ever going to evolve, we need to all get together. We need to work together and realize we're all exploited. We're all victims of a system that does not care about human beings.
Right, and to varying degrees, we are all exploiting each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, and, that's what you learn.
Well, yeah, no, 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 I know, but the and I put this more bluntly, and it gets me in trouble sometimes, but we are all hypocrites. Mm-hmm. And when we can accept the nature of the of our being is hypocritical, then we have to work together with a kind of compassion and a kind of a resolve that we often don't aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your story makes me want to ask, how was it that you could kind of endure the injustice, the beating from the cop, the beating from the African Americans, the beating, you know, how could you endure that kind of injustice and still have, how did that shape your sense of what justice is about? You may have already answered this. But.
Well, I didn't say that I lived in the streets of New York for about 6.5 years. I was a homeless person, so that was an important part of my life.
What years were you on the streets?
From about 1962 to 68. Yeah.
Yeah.
A very tough time. Lots of drugs, lots of violence, lots of guns, lots of knives, lots of police violence. I wasn't always, as rational, if I'm rational today. When I left the city and met my former wife, a policeman was killed. I read about it in the Daily News, and I said, good, I'm glad. And she said, no, that's not right. He's a human being. And I said, no, policemen are not. I said, cops are not human beings. I'm sorry to say that I felt that way. But I felt that way because I had been abused, because I'd seen the police beat people. When you're so down, when you're living in the streets like that, or you're African-American in certain parts of this country, you know, you're a victim totally. You have no recourse. You can't do anything about it.
Right.
I saw so much terrible stuff in New York City. So at times, I was not at all peaceful or rational or kind. I really was full of hatred and anger and vengeance. And I've had to spend many, many years working on that, trying to get to another place because I realized it was destroying me, not the police, not the system, not capitalism, but me.
Right. So, and what have you had to do to work on yourself to let go of that vengeance and rage that is self-destructive and not helpful?
Mm-hmm. A lot of reading, a lot of therapy, psychotherapy, meeting a psychotherapist I went to see her for maybe 10, 15 years, going through something called the Landmark Forum. Most anything I could do because I realized that I needed to do things. I was drinking too much. I was angry. You know, PTSD, that's sort of thrown around. People say, I suffer from PTSD, and a lot of people do. I do, I did, I still do. I've worked on that hard to be more trusting, less angry, less suspicious, all those things that you are when you suffer mm-hmm. from PTSD. But I also think that working with Vietnam veterans, I've been writing about Agent Orange, chemical mm-hmm. warfare mm-hmm. for the last 30 years, and I've met a lot of veterans, Vietnam veterans, and working with them, becoming friends with them, talking with them, listening to them, it's really helped me understand who I am and how I relate. In fact, sometimes these veterans would say, are you sure you weren't in Vietnam? And I said, no, I'm sure I wasn't there. Because we had so many things in common, the way we reacted to certain things. So that really helped me, getting together with Vietnam veterans and working with them and hearing their stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's to the woman that you left New York City with or for, mm-hmm. What did she believe about, you had said that she said you can't say that's a good thing.
She had grown up in the suburbs, a white mm-hmm. Woman. She was a teacher. She graduated from college. Her experience of life was very, very different from mine. Mm-hmm. We could talk and communicate, and we wound up having children together. But living in the streets, the violence I had experienced, the violence I had endured, she really could not understand that. Right. She had no interaction with the police. Most people don't. Most white people they don't have any interaction with the police. They might see programs, television programs mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. the police, but that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground in cities and other parts of the country.
Right, right. And I guess I have a very mixed experience. So it kind of depends on the person, depends on the department, depends on 1 out of 20 of my peers when I was growing up would not make it to the age of 20 because of violence, drug abuse, alcohol, bad health care, or picking a fight with the cops. Yeah. And in that instance, they were wrong. But they didn't need 110 bullets to bring them down. But so I have that experience. But I also have the experience of having one of my dear family members whose life has a second chance because of how compassionately and forcefully the police intervened without hesitating a minute. And so I have both of those realities in my life. And the guy that was gunned down in a hail of 110 bullets was one of the kids I was in Cub Scouts with.
Yeah.
And so, it's these are powerful stories, but they go both ways. And until we can sit with each other as a culture and realize the damage that we have done to each other and we continue to do by our prejudice, it's terrible. Listen,
I have changed my views on the police a great deal because I've gotten to know some. I was when I was working on my doctorate at SUNY Albany, I was working for a magazine. It was a police magazine. So I went out and interviewed people, and I said, this is the first time I've been on the other side of the nightstick. But I got to know these guys, working class. They were men, working class men. And they told me the stories. I listened to their stories. And I'll tell you, I would not want, I don't know how much you could pay me to be a policeman, even in small towns in the United States of America. This country is armed. People mm-hmm. have guns. It's so easy to get guns. And a lot of people just hate the police. They've been, whether they've been abused by them or not. I would not want to be driving around at night in some small town, even outside of Ithaca, New York. And you stop a car, for a headlight or taillight. And the next thing you know, somebody's opens fire on you. So the police are scared. We're all scared. Again, we're angry. And people have guns, and so it's a very volatile and dangerous situation for everybody, really, for all of us.
Yes. And I was stopped for a headlight that was out last December, mm-hmm. and I could feel the kind of anxiety and energy that was coming from the policeman as we were talking, and I can understand why. Right. It totally blew me away on one level, though, because I wasn't expecting it.
Well, they're very, very frightened, and they're probably very angry, I would imagine, because they know a lot of them are trying to do good, trying to be good people, trying to help out, and yet they also know that's a lot of violence against them, a lot of hatred toward them. They do get killed rather often in this country. And again, I want to say they get killed in, you know, when I, such extraordinarily small places, some small town in you know, Alabama, where you wouldn't think anybody would be out there with an AK-47 in their car, but they are.
Yeah. No, no, it's, yes. Let's take a music break. Should we go to... to Here's to the State of Mississippi, or me and Bobby McGee, or John Lennon, or what?
How about Here's to the State of Mississippi? I think it's always a good song.
Okie doke.
Here's to the state of Mississippi, for underneath her borders the devil draws no line. If you drag her muddy rivers, nameless bodies you will find. Oh, the fat trees of the forest have hid a thousand crimes. The calendar's lying when it reads the present time. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Mississippi, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the people of Mississippi, who say the folks up north, they just don't understand, and they tremble in the shadows at the thunder of the Klan. Oh, the sweating of their souls can wash the blood from off their hands. For they smile and shrug their shoulders at the murder of a man. Whoa, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Mississippi, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the schools of Mississippi, where they're teaching all the children that they don't have to care. All the rudiments of hatred are present everywhere, and every single classroom is a factory of despair. And there's nobody learning such a foreign word as fair. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Mississippi, find yourself another country to be part of. And here's to the cops of Mississippi, they're chewing their tobacco as they lock the prison door, and their bellies bounce inside them when they knock you to the floor. No, they don't like taking prisoners in their private little wars. And behind their broken badges, there are murderers and more. Whoa, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Mississippi, find yourself.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Fred Wilcox. So, Fred, we were talking during the song just a little bit. One of my experiences was New York City in the early 80s, when homelessness was once again a big issue, and as it, you know, as it does from time to time, is from time to time. And I said to my future father-in-law that I really would want to know, I would feel like one needs to know what the world looks like from the point of view of someone whose life is on the street. And he just so thoroughly could not understand that, partly because it scared him that the future husband of his daughter would care to be there. But it's hard for people to want to have compassion to that degree with others. You've not only had it, but you've had to live it. You've had to find it.
When I was teaching in the writing department at Ithaca College, I used to sign a paper to my personal essay class called "What Is Fear?" And how does it affect you? How does it control you? How do you live with it? At first, my students were bewildered, and then we really delved into fear, and they started talking about their own fear. And I said, you know, I don't think you can overestimate the role that fear plays in our lives, because why can't we? You know, every so often we rediscover homelessness as though people weren't homeless. Oh, finally, wow, there it is, homelessness again. Why are we so afraid? Well, because we're human, you know, and so my students began to look into it, and they were young. You know, when you're young, you're not going to die. Nothing can really happen to you.
Right.
But it was a very interesting experience when they really began to look at how fear did control their lives, what their parents had told them, what the newspapers had told them, what their teachers had told them, how many times they've been told to fear the other or fear themselves or fear not knowing something. So,
or fear not succeeding and what would happen
absolutely.
To you if you didn't.
Yeah. Well, we examine that. What is success? What do you really mean by success? Yeah. But I think that fear, you know, I went to Europe back in 1970. I remember I had an experience. My wife and I were hitchhiking all over. And I got to the point where I could tell Americans from a mile away why they looked frightened. They looked scared. They were standing on a street corner. They didn't, you know, they weren't moving. And then I got in touch with my own fear because one night we were standing in a train station in Copenhagen and a guy came up and said, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. We didn't have a place to stay. He said, would you like to come over to my mother's? And I just tensed up and he looked at me and laughed. He said, you're a Yank, aren't you? He could see, you know, how frightened I was.
Yes.
I thought, oh yeah, his mother's an axe murderer. You know, they're going to, you know, we went over to the mother's. It was a great place to stay. We got to know him and his mother. It was a wonderful experience. But again and again, I also realized in Europe, because at the time we went over in a freighter and I carried a knife in my boot. I was totally traumatized from all the years I spent in New York City. I was sitting in the back of a car. My wife would get in a car. We were hitchhiking. And I mean, that's the way I was. So I was beginning to understand the role that fear played in my own life, mm-hmm. how distrustful mm-hmm. I was of people and how frightened it. And I have also carried a gun a couple of times in my life, which astonishes me to say that, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And I tell people, you know, when you carry a gun, you believe everybody has a gun. You start to imagine that people are reaching in their pocket, not for their keys, not for a book, not for a Hank Kleenex, but for a gun. So you become extremely paranoid, more and more. The more longer you carry the gun, the longer you have that gun, the more crazier you really get.
Right, right. I guess I grew up with guns, so it's a different
sort
of thing.
Oh, so did I. Yeah.
Perhaps. Were you good with a gun?
Oh yeah, I grew up hunting. You know,
you had control of it.
Absolutely.
You knew how to use it properly.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the problem is with all the people, the 40% of Americans who have guns or however many they are, most of them don't know how to use them properly.
Or
and
store
that's
them.
Really,
you know,
really
or clean
dangerous.
Them.
Yeah,
or keep the safety on. I understand all that.
Okay. Yeah. And even with all of that knowledge, you're saying that carrying the gun makes you more jumpy, more paranoid.
Yeah, because you carry the gun because you're frightened, mm-hmm. and then your fear is exacerbated by your view, your idea that everybody has a gun out there. You think, you know, we used to camp out, my former wife, but we camped out in the woods, these national parks. I had a rifle at the time, 22 rifle. I would keep that thing loaded right by my side. And when a car came into the campground, you know, at night, mm-hmm. I imagined that they were coming there, that they had a gun. And I would take the safety off my gun and be fully ready to have a shootout. Well, they weren't coming there with a gun. They weren't coming there to get me.
Right.
They weren't going to do that. But that's where I was. And you could say, well, you were paranoid from all those years in the city. Yes, I was. But I was also paranoid. Once I just gave up the guns, I have a gun in my house. It's a 410 unloaded shotgun.
Uh-huh. Birds, basically, or rabbits.
Yeah. So I became a lot less fearful when I stopped walking around or driving around with a gun.
Yeah. I mean, fear is a funny thing. When you feed it, I mean, when you try to fix it or protect it, you make it worse.
Well, listen to the national conversation, if it is a conversation about people who are running for office, with one exception, possibly Bernie Sanders. What are they talking about? Well, we need to go somewhere and bomb people. We need to invade another country. We need to kill this whole group of people. Or, you know, and I listen to that and I've heard that stuff all of my life. How did it make the world a better place? How is it ever going to make it? But I understand what they're doing because it's fear. And fear really does work. All demagogues, you know, if you read history, I'm sure you have. Some people have, some people haven't. But other people, read history. You'll see how Hitler, Mussolini, all these people came to power right. because people were frightened. Right. They were scared.
Right. And one of the things I think that has not gotten noticed that should is that the bluster of individualism and which we associate with Trump is no different in effect than the bluster of an agenda that we would associate with Rubio or with Cruz or even with Clinton. The bluster of an agenda is we're going to fix it our way, and it doesn't really matter what the rest of the people think because we have the plan, and that's as egotistical as the individual, you know, charismatic leader.
And what amazes me is no one seems to, you know, none of the media people stand up and say something like that. Say, well, what makes you think that you have the intelligence, the insight, the whatever it might be, you know, to rule the world? Isn't that dangerous in itself? Isn't that terrible thing to look in the mirror and say, I have this, I know, just elect me and I can control the world?
If I could be so bold or have the occasion to have to ask the question, there are two questions I would ask. One is, if you're elected, what would you do to serve the expressed needs of those who were most against you on their terms? What decisions have you made that have had damage and impacts on the lives of others? And what have you done to mitigate those decisions? And what do those people say?
Well, I wish you could say that. Those two questions would eliminate
the imposters across the board.
Yeah.
And they might eliminate all the candidates. I don't know, but we need a much more honest evaluation of where we're headed.
Well, again, I sound like a minor bird here.
Sure.
I don't think we can have that until we look at ourselves and say we're fearful. We're angry, we're bitter, we're afraid, we need scapegoats, we need to hurt somebody else in order to feel better about ourselves. And we're not doing that, and the National Dialogue certainly isn't doing that. And you call these things debates. I watched the Republicans for about 5 minutes when they're yelling and when they're insulting each other, when they're being mocked. You know, the other question I would like to ask them, I'd like to say, like, yeah, I grew up like you think you are. I grew up being masculine, being macho, tough, fighting, getting stabbed, getting beat up. You don't have to be that way to be a man. Yeah, that's not necessary to be a man.
Right. I think we're going to cut to a piece of music now because one of the ones you brought is kind of this self-mocking song from Janis Joplin.
Janis Joplin. I love Janis Joplin.
Well, actually, hold on. I was thinking the song that came to mind was actually not the one you brought. It's the Mercedes-Benz song, Oh Lord, Won't You Buy Me. We live in a culture that's kind of enshrined that kind of egocentrism, but we haven't faced the vacuousness of it. And when you were talking about not facing our fears, we have largely eviscerated the kinds of institutions or organizations, and we have not raised up the individual voices who could help us to do that. And as collectively, you know, collectively, there is a lot of rot in our institutions of religion or even cultural heritage, a lot of preening in cultural identity, racial identity, and in religion. And we need to have these conversations that you're talking about, to have this realization, we need strong leaders who can press that case.
Well, again, Bernie Sanders uses the word revolution, and I, as a Vietnam-era survivor, we've been talking about revolution forever, and I think that's the only answer. You're not going to reform. Reforming Congress is like reforming the mafia. Reforming the banks is like reforming gangsters. You know, we need a revolution. I don't know exactly what Bernie, but I like the idea that he's talking, using that word.
Right. I guess because I saw what that word did to shut people down who were otherwise good people.
Oh, yeah.
I think we need a conversion, a radical reassessment. That's another way of saying a revolution in language that people can sometimes hear that wouldn't hear the revolution word. But we need a major turning of our hearts and our values to something new.
Absolutely.
And it's not reform. It's a complete And in a sense, I say it's not reform, but anybody who studies biology or nature knows that when you move from one thing to the next, it's not a complete disconnect with the past. There's always continuities, and you want the continuities because people can't abide by something that is completely unknown because they'll destroy each other.
Yeah, and when I say revolution, I don't mean I shoot you because you don't agree with me, or I lock you up, you know, because you don't agree with me. We, you know, again, if you study history, you see where revolution.
You see where that happened in France.
Yeah, you see where it leads. But I'm basically what I'm talking about is what you just said, Martin Luther King, that kind of revolution, kind of revolution where we really look into our own heart and soul, but also look into our history. What troubles me always is, as Americans, we keep talking about our glorious history. Well, it isn't glorious. You know, slavery wasn't glorious. Extermination of the Indians wasn't glorious. Vietnam wasn't glorious. We need, if we're ever going to get anywhere, we need to step back from that, our democracy, how great, how loving, how peaceful we are, and just look at what we did do and then decide what do we want to do and how can we do it together. Together, yep. Not as leftist or rightist or centrist or black or white or gay or straight, but together.
How can we ask for the help that we need from others we would not necessarily have trusted to help us?
Yeah, it's very difficult to trust if you see someone who's talking about, you think, destroying you or locking you up or putting you in prison or whatever they're thinking about doing to you.
And there's that level, but there's also the people who want to, quote, help, who've never asked for help themselves.
Yes.
And for me as a pastor in a congregation, I used to have a rule that I don't want you leading an effort to help other people unless you have had to ask for help. And if you can show me where you've done that, you can show me where you can meet the people that you're going to help with as equals.
Very important, because I was a, and still am, but an anti-war, nonviolent activist until, you know, one day I realized I was asking people to be peaceful and I wasn't peaceful. I was asking people to be nonviolent and I wasn't nonviolent. And that was a shock to me. It was a shock to me that what was going on inside of my heart and mind and soul was not very peaceful and not very nonviolent. And so that's the really difficult part, is to look at yourself and say, who am I? How do I think? How do I relate? How do I feel? What would I do in a particular situation? Yes, that's conjecture, but that's the hard part.
And what have I lost by not being my better self?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
that's the lead into the Janis Joplin song you did pick.
Okay.
Which is Me and Bobby McGee.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans.
Slip away.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Fred Wilcox. So, Fred, you made the comment you had the chance to meet Janis Joplin.
I did. When I was living on the Lower East Side, a friend of mine, she actually stayed with him for a while, and I was looking for him, and I climbed the stairs. He lived in a tenement, and knocked on the door, and a woman came to the door with a bottle of whiskey in her hand. She was naked, and I was quite taken aback, and and she said, "You're looking for Kenny." And I said, "Yes." Yeah. Said, "Well, Kenny ain't here." And I said, okay. And then a couple of days later, I went over again, and she was there. And she had a guitar, and we all sat around, drank this, some whiskey. And she played, and she sang. And I took singing lessons when I was a kid. I was a semi-professional singer. And I remember sitting there thinking, man, this woman has a voice. What a voice. She's, yeah. So anyway, she said, the last thing she said to us is, I'm going home to Texas to see my mama. And then I'm going out to California and get famous. So a couple of years later, I had got married. I went back to school at the University of Iowa, and I was in a drugstore someplace, and I saw her. She was in a picture of Newsweek, I think. I grabbed this magazine. I ran about 10 miles home. I bound in the door. My wife said, what's the matter? What's the matter? I said, this is Janis. Look at this, Janis. She did it. And so that's my Janis Joplin story. Uh-huh. I was very excited that she had done exactly what she said to do. Right. She was going to do
it. Right. What I like to kind of focus on as we kind of go into the last segment of the show is what do you do to restore yourself on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly, emotionally, physically, and intellectually? Now, I'm going to talk a little bit while you have a chance to process that question. One of the things that you said earlier in the show was that you think of yourself as more rational now. And one of my concerns is that by rational can merely mean proportional, or it can mean intellectual. And as a culture, we've gotten way too intellectual in our policy wars for the last 50 years, that we've gotten out of touch with what it means to be honest, emotional human beings with each other, and what it means physically, because politics has always been a mix of drama, physical drama, emotional drama, and intellectual sparring. And because we are so incompetent at it as a culture, and I think we are incompetent at bringing it together, it's hard to expect a better performance on the part of any of our leaders, regardless of party, because we're not getting very good performances right now that pull those three ways of engaging the world, mind, heart, and body, into some coherence that we can get behind. So what I want to know from you is, you know, how have you learned to take care of yourself, and when do you know that you need to?
Well, first of all, if I said I was rational, I'd take that back, because I don't
You said a little more rational. Not so reactive was what I heard.
I don't really believe that human beings are rational. I think that's it's a real problem with our species. We're not rational. But what do I do?
Or an opportunity, I would say. I don't want
to. I read a lot. I like to laugh. I like to see. I think people say, well, how did you survive on the Lower East Side? How did you survive being homeless? And I have to say, because there were times when I just laughed. I was sitting in a park, Tompkins Square Park, one night. I had 13 cents in my pocket. The sun was going down. I didn't have any place to go. And I started laughing. You know, that's why Janis Joplin's Nothing Left to Lose. You know, freedom's right. Just not. I think I've always, to a certain extent, seen my own life as funny. And that might sound strange, but even when I was in jail, whatever happened, I thought, well, this is kind of amusing. You know, here I am.
Isn't this odd?
Yeah, isn't
both
this
funny? And, yeah.
This, I could sort of step back. It sounds like I'm schizophrenic, but no, I also have a little dog. His name is Jeffrey. I walk him a lot. I read a lot. I read history. And I think about history. I read about it and think about it. And I think, well, one of the things that fascinates me about, well, let me just, I'm rambling here. But the other night I was over watching The Returns. Okay. And somebody said, oh, those stupid people. And again, I was trying to explain, no, my sisters are not stupid. They're working class people. You know, this is the way they believe. They're angry. They're frustrated. They're bitter. And they might go for Bernie. But that's not because they're stupid. And then I said, listen, here's the problem with the left. We think, just read another book. Just read another article. Just go to another lecture. Just go see Michael Moore. And you will be transformed. Things will change for you. Your life will change. Well, that's a big fallacy. That's one of, I think, our problems. Is we think we can educate people out of poverty. We can educate people out of their anger and their frustration and their irrational, whatever it is, behavior. So one of the things I think that helps me is to step back from that and realize, no, I can't really do that. I'm an educator. I was an educator all my adult life. But I couldn't transform a student by just giving that student another article to read, another something to do, you know, another film or documentary. I gave them everything I could in order to create a conversation, maybe inside of them, not necessarily with me. So I like to go down and walk by the lake. I love nature. I love animals. I love birds. I don't know very much about it because I grew up in a city and have lived with a city a lot of my life. And I also look for things that people do on a daily basis, and I think this is another problem with the progressive left, that are good, that are optimistic, that somebody, I saw the police the other day save a dog's life. And I thought they went out in the water. It was freezing. They could have fallen in. They could have drowned themselves. They went out and saved a dog's life. The dog went through the thin ice. And I like those stories. I like to hear those stories. And I like to focus on those stories rather than just who's killing whom under what conditions.
Right. I'm going to tell a little story. The best preacher in my time at Union Seminary was an Afro-Caribbean woman who was born in the Bronx to Afro-Caribbean parents. I don't remember which island her parents were from. But she spent a chunk of the 60s homeless on the subways and streets of New York. And eventually she got a job working for the IRS. And basically she helped prostitutes file their income taxes so that they would have some Social Security later in life when they needed it, because they would have paid a little in. And the reason she could do it, because she knew the work. She knew how to help them figure out what their liabilities and expenses were and what the profit was and how, so they could pay a little bit in and be on the rolls for getting benefits, because back in the day that mattered.
Right.
And she could preach from that experience, and she was one of the first people to help the churches in the U.S. face the HIV/AIDS crisis in the early mid 1980s. And just incredible power and incredible humor, and she could laugh with a depth of regard for the ridiculousness of this situation that I have never ever heard since. But I just There's an echo in that story from your story.
Well, if you don't laugh, you will go crazy.
Yeah.
If you don't laugh, you will sink into depression. If you don't laugh, figure out things to laugh about.
And her life danced that edge.
Right.
Because that's how hard it is, and that's how much is said in the laughter that comes to carry us away.
Yeah.
In a good way.
I hate to, use up our time talking about Donald Trump, but, sometimes when I see Trump, I laugh. I laugh because he's trying so hard to be macho. He's trying so hard to be tough. And I want to say to him, Trump, that's silly.
Well, and the thing is that he could. There is a traditional male posture which takes a lower voice. And much less agitated motions, and it was more what we would associate with Will Rogers, to speak directly to the heart of the pain of working class America, without a lot of bluster, and that's the opposite tack that he could take, if he knew how to do it, if he could allow himself to be human in that sort of way.
Well, he's a violent person, and he understands the violence of a culture. Mm-hmm. He understands the appeal of violence, because, on the other hand, I can say I laugh about a lot of things. But I'm also absolutely, totally horrified at it. I have a little grandchildren. How are we going to change this? How are we going to change this dynamic? How are we going to become less violent as a culture? And again, I don't think we are until we do something about capitalism, and that, to me, is abolish it. But Trump and all these candidates except maybe Bernie are talking violence, are being violent, and I think we need to look at that and say, is that what we need? Is that what we want? Is that what we support?
And depending upon the implementation of Bernie's plan, he could be talking violence surreptitiously, and that's what makes him scary to people on the right. Mm-hmm. And so, what I would ask you is how do you see the corrosiveness from your point of view of capitalism in your daily life, so that you can begin to address the violence there, or that other people could address the violence if they can see it? We can't address what we cannot see. Mm-hmm. And how would we need to look at our lives? How do you need to look at your life to know when you need to step back because you have walked into a violent space?
Well, I step back from ideology, whether it's political ideology or mm-hmm. religious ideology. I think one of the great problems with human beings is we latch onto ideologies, and then that would enable me to kill you if you're not practicing my ideology. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very necessary to stop saying, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm a communist, I'm a socialist, and try to say, I'm a human being, and think that way and sure. feel that way. The way I'm not poor, but I worked all of my life and I have very little money. And I also feel the insecurities that other people feel who have retired and are trying to live on Social Security and very mm-hmm. small pensions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I realize that basically my country doesn't care about me. I worked hard to get my degrees. I've written books. I thought I was a good teacher. But there isn't necessarily a reward for that in the sense of, okay, we will make sure that you live a fairly comfortable life. And I don't mean driving a Mercedes or having a five-bedroom
right,
apartment.
Right, right. Yeah. Right, and partly that comes up with the hypocrisy that was at the heart of the way Social Security was sold in the first place. Mm-hmm. And part of that was it was sold in two different ways to get it to pass. One is, this is how we will take care of those who are older and unable. And the other one was, this is how people will contribute by virtue of how they've lived their lives, so that the end of life will reflect what they actually did with their lives. So mm. it was kind of an earned justice.
Right.
But
yeah.
those two things work in completely different ways. And because of the fact that we don't really control our destiny or the economy of our nation, it might be better to say that we look after each other with whatever resources we have at the time we need to look after each other. That would be fairer.
Yeah. Well, we have to, because the government isn't going to do
that. No. But the thing is that in many cases, the government would be the logical place to organize that looking out after each other. Mm-hmm. But not naively so. And that's where we got caught up in our own naivete.
Yeah. Well, of course, Social Security, I'm glad I have it because, the conservatives, quote-unquote, want to end it.
Right.
Which is bizarre. It's absolutely amazing to me why they would want to cut off tens of millions of people who worked all their life and have this very minuscule kind of, income. Why would they would want to do that? I don't know. It's an extraordinarily cruel idea.
Fred, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you very much. Nice
do you want to say
you.
Something about John Lennon's Imagine before we close out?
It's my favorite song in the whole world. I love it. I can listen to it over and over again. It always brings tears to my eyes, always.
It's good to get to know you. Thanks.
Thank you.
No hell below us. imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood. And the world.